And now I'd like to go ahead and welcome our main speaker, Ronald from LA.
All right.
Good evening. My name is Ronald White, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to start off by thanking the group for allowing me to have the privilege of coming out and sharing with you. Inette is very persistent. I mean, very persuasive. Anybody who knows her knows what I'm talking about. I want to thank you for inviting me to come out here. I want to congratulate the birthday people. So many birthdays. That's wonderful to see those anniversaries in Alcoholics Anonymous. And our first speaker, Christina. You wasn't supposed to be that good. Okay. I was thinking she should be the main speaker up here. You know. No, not really. No. No. You know how we are in Alcoholics Anonymous. Really. I'm not going to carry around none of that false, you know, stuff. Yeah. But I'll let you know that I respect the sanctuary that we're in. And so I'll make sure that I don't use any profanity this evening. And because I like to cuss. You know, I'm here to, and it was comforting to me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I went to meetings and I heard people who talked the way that I talk. And they weren't saying all these thou shalts and, you know, hither and all. You know, I needed to know that I had a place where I fit in. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and there were people who were comfortable with just talking the way that we talk, you know, and talking about God and not being afraid. See, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. See, I know when I'm in the right place. There's a chapter in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, chapter 7. It's a chapter called Working with Others. That's the chapter that's entirely devoted to our 12th step of recovery. That's the step that says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And it's detailed in masterly fashion in that chapter, how I'm supposed to share with the new man or woman what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And I know it's quite fashionable to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and hear people say, I'm not going to stay in no drunkalog. We all know how to drink. I want to start talking about the steps, about the work, about the process. And I think it's vital that we talked about our plan, program of action that's outlined in our book, those 12 steps of recovery. That give me that design for living that I've incorporated in my life. But you know something? I think it is probably even more important that I share with you what I used to be like. Because there's somebody sitting in this room tonight looking at Ronald White, and I think I look kind of nice. Share it for the people on the tape. He's wearing a beautiful blue suit with a nice silk tie. You know, his shoes are matching one another. You know, it's like, and there might be somebody looking at me tonight saying, he don't look like no drunk. Look at him. He look like a preacher or a teacher or somebody they invited from the Screen Actors Guild, right, to read a script. Right, you know, I know I'm handsome. No, but know this, that sometimes I think we get so caught up into what we're like now that we forget to share with our new friends that I didn't look like this when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. They might be looking at me tonight thinking that I'm somebody special. They've invited me to speak. I must be somebody important. People are hugging me and greeting me up there. And you might think that I can't do that. I know I can't stand up in front of a group. And you might think that's Alcoholics Anonymous. And the way that I dress or the way that I look might be what the program is about. Now, the only reason I dress up when I go to meetings nowadays is because I had a sponsor early on that told me if I ever had the privilege of sharing at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I should at least look sober. Right? Right? He said that there might be somebody new, and I remember what it was like to be new, sitting there through a meeting and not able to hear half of what the speaker is saying, because my head is so rummed up, you know, and I'm so scrammed, and I'm barely catching snatches of what's, but the one thing I remember is the speaker looked good. Right? The speaker looked, he was smiling, that he looked like he was sober, right? And he looked, and sometimes that might be all that that newcomer can see in the beginning. And man, I want to let anybody know from the inside out, because anybody can dress up the exterior, but it's that interior. It's the inside job that is the most important thing that I've accomplished in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you don't know that, at the end of my story, I want you to go home with me. Okay? No, I don't think my wife would like that. I'll rescind that invitation, right? You know, but I need to let you know that when I arrived on the doorstep of Alcoholics Anonymous on my first day, July the 14th of 1986, it was a Monday morning, and I was standing in the lobby of a joint called the Harbor Light Center. It's a place run by the Salvation Army, and it was located on what we in Los Angeles call the Nickel, Fifth Street, Skid Row. The Salvation Army Harbor Light Center is an all-men's alcoholic recovery facility, housing 150 beds for alcoholic men. I'm standing in that lobby being interviewed, and I ain't talking about no job interview, y'all. I'm talking about one of those intake interviews. They're giving you, see if they're going to give you one of those beds, right? And there was an old black guy named George who was doing the interview. He had a folder with a series of questions. You know those complex questions they ask you to see if they're going to give you a bed. Mr. White, how much do you drink? I was stunned. Oh, shit. Right? And I remember I mumbled my answer. And then George asked me another question, and I mumbled the next answer. And George is asking me the questions, and I'm mumbling my answers as I'm looking down at these beat-up holy tennis shoes that I'm wearing. Now, I'm looking at these tennis shoes while George is asking me these questions because it felt as if my chin was stapled to my chest because I was so ashamed of being there. I couldn't even look George in the eye. And George is asking me the questions, and I'm mumbling my answers as my eyes traveled up from those beat-up tennis shoes and rested upon some gray corduroy pants that I'm wearing. Now, the pants are real dusty and dirty because I've been on a run for 4 or 5 days and hadn't bothered to change. If I had hit the pants too hard, a cloud of smoke would have filled the lobby. They were that filthy. I had a gray T-shirt that matched those corduroy. Well, it wasn't supposed to match. It was supposed to be a white T-shirt, but you know how it was slick and greasy and sweaty and oil. You know how we are when we're out there in them streets, right? I had a big black overcoat on because by now I have no... When I drink, I don't bother to eat. So imagine me 40 or 50 pounds lighter than I am this evening. I look like a skeleton, cheeks sunk in, eyes popping out my head. So I wore this overcoat everywhere that I went because I didn't want you to see how malnourished I had become. And I'm not talking about no nice, beautiful top coat or no cashmere or no London fog or, you know, nothing like that. I'm talking about one of those black, seedy, Chester the Molester looking coats, right? I could just say, ah, right? I was not a vision for you. And there was this stench I had on me. You know the smell that the drunk has on them constantly, because now I've been drinking for years and it's coming through my pores and I haven't bathed. And then, you know, you're wearing the same drawers, the same underwear you've been wearing for weeks, and it's gotten black and caked. You almost have to peel it up. Wait a minute, don't judge me. Oh, I know where I am, right? I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. I ain't the only one, right? Some of you guys in here know what I'm... Wait, don't let me discriminate. Some of you women in here know what I'm talking about, right? Because I'm a drunk. When I drink, I become an animal. And so I'm standing in that lobby answering those questions that George asked, hoping desperately that they would give me a bed. Because I was tired. Because I had no hope. I felt hopeless and I felt helpless. It wasn't one of my aspirations to grow up to be standing in the Harbor Light Center at age 31 begging them for a bed. It wasn't one of the top 10 goals in my life to become a drunk. In fact, quite the opposite. I thought that I would never be an alcoholic because I didn't drink anything for the first 18 years of my life because my father was a drunk. My father was what we call back in the day a wino. I grew up in South Central Los Angeles, raised by a mother and father, and I have five brothers. There's six boys. I think you may have even heard from one of my brother Ralph. He came here a few months ago and shared with you guys. So if you hear some similarities in our stories or whatever, I'm not the same speaker. We just have the same mother and father, right? You know. My father loved to drink a fine little beverage called Ripple. Some of you guys are old enough to remember Ripple. Cheap wine, right? Back with the made in the 50s and in the 60s. My father loved it. He smelled of it, had always empty Ripple bottles lying around the house. He would get paid on Friday, never made it home until Sunday. When he made it home, he was always broke. My mother would meet him at the door when he would stagger in, and she would ask him, "Ralph, what happened to you? What happened? We've got all these boys to feed and you couldn't bring home a dime." And I remember as if it were yesterday, he would mumble something you couldn't understand, or he would cuss my mother out like she had done something wrong. And when he cussed my mama out, he made her cry. And when he made my mama cry, I looked at this dude with hatred. I hated him for being so weak. I hated him for being such a punk. I hated him for not loving us enough to bring home the money. I hated him for being an alcoholic. And I swore, as I grew up in this little apartment on 108th and Central in the middle of Watts, South Central Los Angeles, I swore I would never grow up to be like him. And for the first 18 years of my life, because of that vow, because of that resentment, I didn't drink anything. But you know something? Even while growing up not drinking, I still had what I've come to know as the ism of alcoholism. If you are a fan of our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, in the front portion of our book, they have something called the doctor's opinion. This doctor who worked with one of our co-founders, Bill Wilson, who he treated in his hospital, Towns Hospital in New York City. And he said he had treated thousands of alcoholics and drug addicts and noticed that from studying them, they had certain things in common. One of the things he noticed that they seemed to have what he called an allergic reaction to alcohol. When they drank, they seemed to crave more. But that didn't really interest me when I first read the doctor's opinion, because I told y'all I didn't drink for the first 18 years of my life. But Dr. Silkworth wrote something else. He said these alcoholic men and women, when not drinking, seem to suffer from feelings of being irritable, restless, and discontented, kind of not at ease with themselves, diseased. And I identified with that because you see, even before I started drinking, I've always felt diseased. I've always felt a part from rather than a part of. I've always felt, even in my own family, six boys, we were all each other's best friends. We played together. We did all this. But I always felt different because out of all six of us, and I'm the third oldest, why am I the shortest? I always hated being so damn short. That don't mean nothing to y'all except the other short guys in here. I see y'all. And interestingly enough, usually tall women come up to me at the end and they tell me they felt that way. Just out of place. Kind of not, just, my story is not always that I felt less than. a lot of times I felt better than in my head. I've always hated being so dang black. And I don't mean being black, but damn it, so black. Even black people discriminated against me, right? It's just like, you black so-and-so. No, I'm brown. No. Then the Hispanics took that from me. I can't even say I'm brown, right? I've worn glasses since I was in the second grade. I've always been called Poindexter, Mr. Peabody, the professor, right? You know, I can name a litany of things that I hated about myself when I was growing up. I needed a drink. Shoot. To help me escape from the prison of my thinking. But I could not drink because I didn't want to become my daddy, right? And so I had to find something to help me escape. And the thing that I found that worked for me in the beginning were books. I became addicted to reading. Libraries became my sanctuary because, you see, when I read, I escaped. And I was no longer in Watts. I was no longer on 108th and Central. I was transported to distant lands. I was somewhere in Paris or in London. I used to love spy novels, espionage. And I used to be transformed into the heroes in these books. They weren't like me, short, dark, poor, you know, with a drunk father. They were guys who were suave and debonair. They were rich and famous. They were saving the world or getting the girl at the end of the story. They knew karate. Hi! Look at that. No lessons, right? Just. And they saved me. These stories saved me. But I understand, looking back on my thinking, on anything I've ever used that's helped me get out of myself. It later became alcohol and other substances, but started with those books. Anything that I've ever used, after a while of using it, it didn't seem to have the same effect as it did in the beginning. And I require more. I need something bigger, stronger, faster. And those library books, those novels didn't get me out of myself the same way, and I needed something else, and I discovered comic books because the stories were shorter and quicker and the heroes were bigger and stronger. I used to put a towel around my neck and I would be transformed into a superhero, and I would be running around Watts with a towel around my neck. I don't know if y'all know about Watts. It was not cool to be doing that. But you know something, when I put on that towel, when I put on that cape, I felt no fear. Because it made me feel strong, heroic, and powerful. And even back then, lack of power was my dilemma. And I was willing to do anything to feel the sense of power. Progressive disease. After a while, I did start feeling foolish wearing that towel. And I needed something else. My family purchased a small little black and white television, and I fell in love with TV. Some of you guys remember the early days of TV. This was in the early 60s, right? You know, and we had this little black and white TV, and they used to call me the human TV guide. I knew whatever was on any channel, any time of the day, any day of the week. My brother would play a game. The neighbors would come over and they say, "Hey man, watch this. Ronnie, Wednesday, 8 o'clock. Oh, 8 o'clock? Channel 2 is Gunsmoke, Channel 4 is Mannix, Channel 5 is Donna Reed, Channel 7 is Petticoat Junction." Now, some of our younger members look real puzzled when I start naming those shows. But I got some of my contemporaries in there. Y'all know that's what we used to watch, right? Every day. And thank God they didn't have cable. All I had to memorize was like 7 channels, you know, and that was it. There was one TV show that I gravitated to that later became one of the guiding forces in my life. You guys may remember the show. It was a show called Perry Mason. Perry Mason was a criminal defense attorney played by an actor named Raymond Burr. Raymond Burr was one of the handsomest dudes I'd seen on television. Tall, broad-shouldered, jet black hair, slick back, beautiful black suits that he was, I think they were black. It was black and white television. dark suits that he would wear, right? You know, he'd walk around the courtroom with a command and a presence. His client was always in jeopardy on trial for murder, right? And he would look like they were about to go down, and Perry would have that last witness on the witness stand, right, trying to break him. And Paul Drake, his private eye, would run in the back door with a little note that he'd hand Perry. And Perry would look at that witness, and the witness would start to sweat and get nervous. And Perry would just close there and just, isn't it true? And then, yes, yes! Right? Somebody in the back of the courtroom would jump up. I did it. That's who I wanted to be. I wanted to be Perry Mason because Perry had power. He had the power to bend people's will to his simply by the force of his presence and his words. And I thought maybe I could do that. So I grew up wanting to be Perry Mason. I wanted to be a lawyer. As I came through school, I was a straight-A student at every level of school that I went through junior high school and high school, because my addiction to reading made me ready-made for school. I was the most articulate kid in every class that I was in. I was very well-read. The teacher would always call on me to read the lessons. I was good at writing essays and exams because I had this vivid imagination from all those books and movies and TV shows that I ingested, right? And so I'm one of the original nerds, right? You know, I am just great in class. I get to Locke High School, I start playing music, I play trombone, and I join this marching band. They called us the Locke High Marching Saints. And we were really faint. We marched in the Rose Parade in Pasadena on New Year's Day. We went to Hawaii for the Aloha Parade in March. A few of us joined, I had a jazz band that we formed where we went to the Hollywood Bowl and won sweepstakes in the Battle of the Bands for the best jazz band in the nation. I was elected my senior class president when I got to the 12th grade. I got accepted to go to college to Loyola University. It's now Loyola Marymount University in Westchester, a private Jesuit school, and I get accepted to go there on a full academic scholarship because of my grades. I get a free ride all the way through school. This kid from South Central Los Angeles, right? It sounds like I had some accomplishments, right? Sounded like I did some things I could be proud of, that some blessings, right? But I am an alcoholic in waiting. I still haven't taken the first drink, but I have the ism. The way it shows up for me is this. I cannot enjoy what I have because I'm too busy looking at what you have. My glass is never half full, it's always half empty. That anything I've ever strived to achieve, when I get it, it doesn't seem to have the effect I thought it was. It ain't enough. Or if it was good in the beginning, I get tired of it. Like a kid on Christmas Day, I play with it, and then what's next? The story of my life. I just don't want to be me. I always want to be somebody else. I never wanted to be no scholar, no academic. I wanted to be a quarterback, somebody scoring touchdowns, somebody that was being written up in the LA Times, somebody that the girl, they had cheerleaders on the sideline cheering for him, right? Nobody ever came in science class, yes, Ronald, that's the right answer. Right? Ego. I understand, man, that I need to be. People probably told me I was smart, told me I was good at doing it, but I didn't want to be smart. I wanted to be cool. I wanted to be somebody who knew how to talk to the girls, that could make them laugh. I always pretended I'd had sex, never had it, right? You know, I am trying to act like I'm better than these other guys, but on the inside, I've always felt less than. And feeling like a fake and a phony and a fraud, pretending to be something that you're not, try doing that for years. My 12th grade class gave a beach party to celebrate our graduation. I saw a guy and a girl underneath a blanket, and I wanted to get underneath a blanket. But everybody knows I'm the professor and I don't get underneath blankets. And somebody was passing around something, I wish I remember what it was, because it became my first drink. It was either some Tyrolia or some Spinata. Cheap wine, just like my daddy used to drink. Because you see, by now, my thinking told me I could take a drink and I'll never become my father. My father was a high school dropout. I'm going to college on a full scholarship. I'm smarter than him. My daddy was a custodian, a janitor. I'm going to be the next Perry Mason. I'm better than him. My ego told me I could take a drink and I'll never become him. So I drank. Only another alcoholic can truly understand the effect produced in me by alcohol. Alcohol made me feel taller. It made me feel bigger. It made me feel lighter. It made my hand go in my pocket and I got this lean and I just felt cool. And it freed me from every fear and inhibition that I had ever had. There's a lady in Alcoholics Anonymous who describes the way alcoholic. I wish I was a woman because I'll use her line anyway. She says, it made me feel wittier, prettier, and tittier. And it freed me. Alcohol saved me. It saved me from the insanity of my thinking. But unfortunately, the thing that was the weapon that freed me in the early days in college, that helped me fit in, that helped me be able to be comfortable in an uncomfortable circumstance, in a circumstance I'd never been in, after a couple of years of drinking, after a while, I needed more. And I don't want to just feel good at the parties on the weekends. I wanted to feel good on Wednesday. And I wanted to feel that way on Tuesday. Now I'm drinking every day. Daily drinking starts to take a toll on you because now I can't study quite as much. So now my grades start to slip and I have to start cheating on my exams to keep up. My character started to change because you see, drinking couldn't change because that's what freed me. So now everything else has to start fall in line with the drinking because I'm going to keep doing that because that's the thing that makes me feel this way. Respecting the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, I need to let you know, I don't share in detail about the other substances that I started using in addition to my drinking. But best believe I'm a garbage can because I am a student of more. Somehow I graduated from college on time. I think it was because of that late start I got with drinking. And I graduated from Loyola in 4 years and got accepted to go to law school, pursuing Perry Mason. I went to a law school located in the city of San Francisco called Hastings College of the Law, one of the most prestigious law schools in the nation. I didn't know that at the time. I was really only running away because I got accepted to go to Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. But I thought those drunk brothers of mine, because we all ran together and drank together and used together. And I knew if I stayed in L.A., I'd never pass law school because they're going to drag me down. Right. And so I ran away to San Francisco. I know that now as a geographic. Right. Because unfortunately, I took the wrong brother to San Francisco with me. Me. And my disease flourished. I sped through law school. I went to law school, summer school after first and second year, and I graduated from law school early in 2.5 years. I'm 23 years old. The rest of my classmates were finishing that last semester, and they got a test you got to take to be a lawyer called the bar exam. They were giving one in February, and my graduation isn't until May. So I take the test because I know nobody passes it the first time. And I take the test, and the results come out on the day of my graduation. And while I'm getting dressed, with my family having flown up from Los Angeles, and we're in my apartment, I'm putting on the cap and gown, getting ready to go to ceremony, and there's a pounding on my door. My best friend busted into my apartment. He said, Ronald, guess what? They just posted the bar results, and you passed. And at age 24, I become one of the youngest black attorneys ever licensed to practice law in the state of California. And it always amuses me when people clap during that part of my share because you won't be clapping for a while. Because best believe, the worst thing you can give a drunk is some success. Because my ego blew up. Because it told me everything you've been doing up to this point must be the way you're supposed to do it. And in fact, let's put this in hyperdrive, right? And so by the time I was 30, I knew I was going to be a millionaire. By the time I was 30, I was broke. I didn't even have a bank account. By the time I was 30, I didn't have a house on the hill, a mansion, nor a condominium. I was living back at home with my mother, sleeping on her floor. By the time I was 30, I did not have a job for a law firm on Wilshire and Westwood. The only job I had was carrying out the trash and watering the lawn for a 21-year-old dope dealer who lived right across the street from my mother's house. I cannot even imagine the shame and degradation that my mother felt looking at this son she had just been so proud of 5 years before. And I am virtually prostituting myself in her neighborhood, in front of her friends and her neighbors. And now I'm the one making my mother cry. And I've become my father. You see, alcohol is no respecter of intellect. It don't care if you graduated from law school or if you dropped out from high school. Alcohol doesn't care if you grew up in Westwood or in Watts. Alcohol doesn't care if you're black or if you're white. Alcohol doesn't care if you're a man or if you're a woman. Alcohol don't care if you're short or if you're tall. Alcohol is an equal opportunity ass kicker. If you suffer from the disease that I suffer from, that is first of all physical in nature, because what the doctor, Dr. Silkworth, wrote in the big book now does become true for me. That when I have one drink in any form, there is a craving that is created in my body that makes it more paramount to get the next one more important than anything else in my life. I stole the food out of my mother's refrigerator to cook plates for people around the neighborhood so I could get one. I stole her shoes out her closet. I stole a gold watch my mother had been given by this job. See, some of our new friends might not really know the power of the craving of that first one that still exists in me now. If I were to take one 32 years later, let me take one. And the allergic reaction that will take place, my mother raised me and my brothers by herself when she put that drunk father out of mine when I was 9 years old. She wasn't educated at the time. She didn't have a high school diploma. She was on welfare for a minute. But she wanted more for her boy. So she started taking jobs, cooking and cleaning for other people's families to keep us fed while she went to night school to get her high school diploma. She was very involved in our lives during this time also. She was president of the PTA, made sure we were in church every Sunday. On the bus, we never had a family car. She would get six boys dressed and get them on the bus every Sunday to get us to church to make sure we were spiritually fed. This is a woman that wasn't satisfied. Once she got that diploma, she wanted more, so she continued at school, now got two jobs so she could get a college degree. She got that degree, and she got a job for Prudential Insurance Company, where they loved her so much, they didn't wait for her to retire to give her a gold watch for their appreciation. I stole that watch for a drink. I love my mother more than life. She sacrificed everything for me and my brothers. I would say I would kill anybody who would hurt my mother. And yet I'm the wolf at the door. Let me have a drink. The craving knows nothing about love, honor, trust, respect. That's not the worst part of my illness, because you would think with that experience that I would know, don't do that. Don't ever take the first one, right? But there's something about my thinking. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the chapter called More About Alcoholism, they need to call it More About Relapse, because it describes the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking. My thinking would tell me, this time it's going to be different. A guy whooped me so bad one time, and I came home, and my mother bathed me, fed me, prayed over me, and my mother can pray. And we were rocking and holding hands and crying. And I told my mother, Mama, I'm never going to do this again. And I meant it with everything in my being. I meant it. And on Monday, I didn't drink. And on Tuesday and on Wednesday, somewhere around Thursday, my head said, that ass whipping wasn't that bad. Where did that come from? No alcohol in my system, right? Dry for 3 days. Notice I didn't say sober. Dry for 3 days. No alcohol in my system. And my thinking just changed. And on Friday, I'm loaded. I am unable to recall with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even days ago. I am unable to bring it into my consciousness with sufficient force to stop myself from having the next one. And that didn't happen just once. That happened over and over for years. And until I can be relieved of the dis-ease of my spirit, where I will pay the ultimate price for ease and comfort. It used to come with books and with a cape and with a television, and now it's come with alcohol. And once that alcohol has a hold of me, that obsession, it tells me that it will one day continue to fix me even when it stopped. Only disease I know that's kicking my ass and telling me I'm having fun. What kind of disease is that? On July the 13th, a guy tried to beat me to death in front of my mother. I had stolen some money from him, and he wanted it back, and I had a bright idea. I said, if I just tell him I don't have his money in front of my mother, she had just gotten dropped off from church in some beautiful church clothes, I've become a coward. I'm going to take this wolf in my mother's house, unmindful of her welfare. And I take him there. His name was Kenny. And I said, Kenny, I'm sorry I don't have your money, man. And Kenny is very reasonable. He says, Ronnie, it's cool. We can make credit arrangements. Let's just step out on the porch. I should have gotten the message, but I'm a real drunk. I'm always full of myself. And I'm thinking, oh, I got over one more time. And I step out on the porch where Kenny's waiting on me, and he must have hit me as hard as he possibly could. I found myself flying across my mother's front yard like a superhero without a cape. I land on the yard, and he proceeds to kick me in the head and stomp me, trying to kill me. As he did this, it felt as if I were removed from my body watching this happen. And I'm looking at Kenny kicking me and stomping me, and I look over and I saw Mama come out on the porch. And I expect her to say, stop, stop, that's my baby. But she says nothing. And I look at Kenny, and Kenny is still kicking me and stomping me. And I look back at Mama, and she turns around, and she walks back in the house, and she closes the door. And it was at that moment that I experienced step one. The very next day is when I went to the Harbor Light Center in the state I described to you at the beginning of this meeting, more dead than alive, and they gave me a bed. And I did nothing but eat and sleep for the next 7 days while they detoxed me, and then they started bringing me to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, where I started sitting in the front and listening like only a dying person could hear. There were men and women sharing from podiums like this one, and they shared with me that I would come, and then I would come too. And then I would come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Step two in the program of recovery, the spiritual solution to my spiritual problem. They told me I needed to find a power bigger than Ronald because Ronald wasn't big enough to beat that alcohol. I tried and I lost. And I needed to find a power. They tried to disguise it, but I said, y'all talking about God, aren't you? Many of us call it God. They say, but you can call it what you want. We like to say higher power so that you can put the name on it that you feel comfortable with. But yeah, a lot of us call it God. And I thought I was lost because I'd been raised in church and I knew about God. I believed in God. I just thought that God didn't want to have nothing to do with me. If you had done the unspeakable acts of betrayal and treachery and deceit that I had done out there in those streets, what God would want to have anything to do with an animal like me? And wasn't my life evidence of that? They told me, Ronald, God had not ever abandoned you. Who do you think carried you through that to this place? We got a chapter for a guy like you. Chapter 4 is a chapter called We Agnostics, the Spiritual Kindergarten. In the pages of that chapter, I discovered that I needed to set aside everything that I thought I knew about God, about spiritual terms. I need to become open-minded on all these matters because I have to, my life depends on it. There's a line in that chapter that I love so much. It says this: deep down, deep inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. That he has sometimes been obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things. But it tells me that if I am willing to search fearlessly, where? Within myself, not without myself, within myself. We believe in the final analysis, it is only there he can be found, and I got hope. I've always looked for God in the sky, in a preacher, in my mother, and somebody else who's always seemed so much more godly, so much more spiritual than me. And what God would want to reside in this little piece of a man? They told me, Ronald, you have just piled so much garbage on top of the power. But we have a process to uncover, discover, and discard the wreckage you've placed on top of the power. And we promise you, Mr. White, we promise you that if you're willing to take certain simple steps, you will find the sunlight of your spirit. And I got hope. I was in the Harbor Light Center for 130 days. And they took me to a second phase of their program, a sober living called Harmony Hall. Harmony Hall is when they start to get the men back into real life, back into society. Get us our clothing vouchers and driver's license and all the stuff you've lost on the street. Forgot to share with y'all, I thought when I got sober I'd never be a lawyer again because I've been practicing law without a license. Never paid my bar dues. I would drink up the money. I know I'm a lawyer. Why do I need to pay dues? So when I got sober, I thought I could never be a lawyer again. First job I got through that sober living was being a bookkeeper for a little old lady who had a nursing home. That might sound fancy. Let me share with you what I did. I would catch the bus to this lady's house, and this lady would give me a stack of her bills and take her checkbook, and she signed a bunch of blank checks, and she handed it to me, said, Mr. White, I want you to pay all my bills, balance my checkbook, and I'll be back in a couple of hours. And she left me alone in her house with a bunch of blank signed checks. And I'm 5 months sober. And I'm scared. When she came home 2 hours later, I was sitting in the same place where she had left me. I handed her her bills. They were all sealed up with checks inside. I gave her her checkbook. There were no checks missing, and the book was balanced. There was nothing missing in her house. She paid me $40 a week to do that job. And when I caught the bus back to Harmony Hall with that $40 in my pocket, I felt 10 feet tall. Because it had been a long time since anybody had trusted me and I hadn't burned them. And I knew there was something about that spirit that gotten so sick when I was drinking was changing. And I grew closer to the power. When I was a year and a half sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, walking around, speaking from the podium, the program works, keep coming back. And somebody walked up to me at the end of the meeting, Ronald, you talk about how you trust in God and believe in the program. Why aren't you contacting the state bar to find out what's happening with your license? Living in fear in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. If I think the answer is going to be no, I just won't even ask. I fear rejection so much. One of my defects. I called the state bar. They said, you haven't been disbarred, but you have been suspended for non-payment of dues, $2,500. Pay all your back dues, you can get your car back. $2,500 sounded like $25,000 because I had a minimum wage job. But it's amazing how much money you could save when you're not drinking. Half of every paycheck for the next 6 months, and I wrote a check for $2,500 to the state bar, and they gave me my bar card back. I applied for a job with the Los Angeles County Public Defender's Office. I wasn't real confident because you know how you got that gap in your resume, you know. I don't know how I'm gonna explain that. And these lawyers were interviewing me in the interview, right? And I thought I got by. Nobody had asked me about the resume. And this smart ass lawyer at the end of the table, Mr. White, we've been looking at your resume. Why haven't you been practicing for the last 2 years? I said, sir, I'm an alcoholic. I did not intend on telling them that. It just popped out. I said, I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober for the last 2 years. They said, Mr. White, lawyers do a lot of drinking. Don't you think the stresses of this position might make you want to drink again? I said, sir, it was stressful when I was out there. I said, I think God has prepared me to do this job. And they looked at me funny. I don't think they hear God. God, who is that? Is that a reference? They don't know. That's my best reference. They said, we'll let you know if you're on the waiting list or we can contact you in 10 days. I went home not feeling real confident. They called me 3 hours later, said, we want you in for another interview. I said, shoot, probably want me to pee in a bottle. But I'm 2 years sober. I am willing. When I showed up that Friday, I saw the head public defender of Los Angeles County, Wilbur Littlefield. Mr. Littlefield didn't ask me to pee in a bottle. He just had me sit on a chair, started walking around talking about what public defenders do. For about 15 minutes, and then he just stopped. And he looked at me, and he walked over to where I sat, and he held out his hand to me. And he said, Ron, we'd be proud to have you join our office. Didn't he know just 2 years before I was stealing the food out of my mama's refrigerator? Watering the lawn for the dope man. What is that but a miracle? Alcoholics Anonymous takes broken up pieces of men and women, working with the guidance of a loving God who works through the unselfish men and women who toil in this fellowship, and we put the pieces back together again. It was as if each man and woman who sits in this room tonight were standing in the lobby of the Harbor Light Center when I arrived there, more dead than alive, with my chin on my chest, too ashamed to look you in the face, and you guys walked up to me and you place your hand underneath my chin and you lifted up my head. And even more than that, you wrap your arms around me. As dirty and as filthy and as nasty as I was, you wrap your arms around me and you literally love me back to life. See, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous isn't about who's got the most babies, who's got the biggest car in the parking lot, who's got the best pitch from the podium. Alcoholics Anonymous is about gaining access to the power that I've come to know that is so great, so good, so forgiving, so loving, it can do anything but fail. I'm gonna take 2 minutes and I'm gonna try to wrap this up. 28 years ago, almost 28 years ago, I got married in Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody actually wanted to marry me. And she stayed with me all this time, supported me, supported my sobriety, had my son, who's 28 years old now, presented me with a daughter that she was already in her life, and I'm her dad now, who's given us 4 grandchildren. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. After having gotten my law license back, I was able to practice for the public defender's office for 12 years and then have my own practice in my own office for 15 years. Alcoholics Anonymous isn't all about pink clouds and fairy tales either. We have adversity in Alcoholics Anonymous. I need to let you know that 4 years ago, I was sitting in the car of my parking lot of my law office contemplating suicide. I'm reading a letter from the State Bar of California telling me of their intention to disbar me, to take away my license because of my representation of somebody who had embezzled $1 million from one of their clients, and I didn't do my job and watch over this person like I was supposed to. And they're taking my license, and I felt shame, and I felt disgrace, and I thought, who in Alcoholics Anonymous would ever respect me again? Who would ever want to see or hear from me again? And see pride and ego again. Because I think that what I do is who I am. I don't know which person it was that I had hugged, which meeting it was I had gone to, which sponsee it was I had listened to a fifth step from, which person it was who had given me an encouraging word in Alcoholics Anonymous that kept me connected to the power in that moment that got me home to my wife. And when my wife looked at me and saw the pain in my face and stuff, and I expected her to say, how could you? Or all this, she just hugged me and she says, honey, we're going to be okay. And when I told my mother and she cried, She says, son, you're going to be okay. And I talk to people in Alcoholics Anonymous that I respect, and they says, Ronald, you're going to be okay. I said, but who's going to want to hear from me? I'll have to use one bad word because this is a quote. They told me, Ronald, don't you know in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more you fuck up your life, the more we want to hear it? Not because of falling down, but we want to know, how did you not drink through that? God. I work in recovery now, and God has blessed me infinitely in more ways than I could ever imagine. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you for letting me share.